When the Sugar House Casino opens in Philadelphia next week, it will join a growing list of places on the East Coast where you can play blackjack and poker. This casino boom is running into an unexpected obstacle, though, a shortage of qualified dealers. Reporter Joel Rose tried his luck at a college in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, that's training dealers to meet the demand.
The dealer training program at Northampton Community College doesn't look like anything I remember from school. The classroom is more like the pit of a casino, with felt-covered tables for poker, roulette, and blackjack.
Here we have a game of blackjack and the equipment that is used and needed to deal the game of blackjack.
Instructor David Cleveley starts with the basics, how to handle the chips and how to shuffle the cards correctly.
That's a nice, gentle riffle. If I hear this, then I know you're not doing it correctly. This is wrong. Listen. Too loud. That means you're bending them too much. You gently let them fall into each other. Very gently. Push in the corners. Try that. I'll be round. I'm going to another table.
Turns out most casual gamblers shuffle the wrong way, showing the bottom card to other players. Let me see your shuffle here.
My shuffling? Oh, my God.
Kevin Ashner of Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, is looking to change careers. Ashner spent 35 years in manufacturing until the sheet metal factory where he worked shut down 9 months ago.
I'm really bad at gambling, so I thought, well, if I can't win the money, maybe I'll deal the cards.
And how's it going for you?
So far, so good. It's a lot to learn, actually. It's not as easy as it looks, and like anything else, you got to practice, practice, practice.
Ashner is one of 180 students enrolled in the program, and he's a bit of an exception. Many of the students are still looking for a first career, and most already feel at home in casinos, having spent many hours on the customer's side of the table.
Stone Park.
Tyler Baltz is a bartender from Nazareth, Pennsylvania.
I feel like I've always had a passion for this. I've gone to many casinos, seen how it all goes down, and now I'm here, and hopefully I can get a job getting out of these classes and start what I want to do.
Baltz and his classmates are expecting to earn about $40,000 a year, plus benefits. The overall unemployment rate in Pennsylvania is a little over 9%. But for these students, the odds look pretty good.
As long as they take these classes seriously, they get the skills, I think they'll see employment because the jobs are there.
David Schweiger directs the hospitality program at Northampton Community College, which works closely with Mount Airy Casino and Sands Bethlehem, both in eastern Pennsylvania. Schweiger says casinos statewide have been scrambling to hire enough dealers since table games were legalized over the summer.
There's 9 casinos now. The 10th is about ready to open, and all 10 of them have employment opportunities.
Workers at the Sugar House Casino in Philadelphia apply the final touches before the scheduled opening on Thursday. With so many casinos on the East Coast now offering table games, some industry observers predict a shortage of gamblers. But Sugar House General Manager Wendy Hamilton says she's not worried.
A good 50 or more percent of the business in Atlantic City has for 30 years come from the Delaware Valley. So I don't think that the Philadelphia region is anywhere near saturation.
Hamilton says Sugar House has trained and hired 160 dealers, enough to staff 40 games, though she's going to wait and see how things go before adding any more. For NPR News, I'm Joel Rose in Philadelphia.
U.S. wheat prices have jumped nearly 50% over the past few months, thanks to a combination of events. Drought and wildfires in Russia prompted that country to ban exports through next year, cutting the supply on the international market. And Canada says its production will be lower than expected. But as NPR's Jeff Brady reports, it's still hard to say what this will mean for the price of bread and other products that use flour.
At the beginning of this summer, wheat was selling for about $5 a bushel in the U.S. Then Russia announced its export ban, and prices rose to $7 a bushel. Michael Denton is a partner at business consulting firm Oliver Wyman.
So it's put a lot of stress on the international market for wheat. Inventories are still at a relatively decent level, but there's a lot of nervousness about how that's going to play out as the season comes to harvest.
Denton co-authored a report that says higher prices could cost the food industry $2 billion this year. And considering the current economy, those companies may not be able to pass those extra costs along to consumers. Jim Greco is CEO of the Brugger's chain of bagel bakeries.
We purchase approximately 13 million pounds of wheat a year.
Fortunately for Greco, he doesn't have to decide whether to raise prices quite yet. Brugger's buys its wheat a year in advance, and the company hopes prices will level out in the meantime. But if they don't, Greco says a 50% increase in wheat prices would be difficult for his company to digest. Jeff Brady, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm David Green. Now to a view from the White House on the economy and the contentious issue of tax cuts. The House of Representatives will be focused on that issue next week when it votes on a package of tax breaks and loan incentives for small businesses. Yesterday, the Senate overcame Republican objections and approved the bill. Still looming is the debate over those Bush-era tax cuts that expire at the end of the year, namely whether to extend cuts that benefit the highest income levels.
We're going to talk about taxes and the economy now with Austin Goolsbee. He was recently named chairman of the White House Council of Economic Advisers. Austin, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me, Melissa.
Part of what is fueling the debate over taxes is the concern that letting that tax break expire on income above $250,000 is going to hurt some small businesses. How do you address that concern?
First of all, the president's totally committed to helping small business has been pressing for months to get the small business bill passed that would give them credit and cut taxes for small business eight different ways. So it's clear that the president has a commitment there. On these rates, let's remember two things. First, most of the income that would see the rates go up on that income has nothing to do with small business. They're just generic rate cuts for very high-income people.
But some of it does apply to some small business owners who file in a certain way. So what about those people? Why shouldn't they be afraid of this?
Well, as I say, more than 97% of small businesses, that would have no impact on them. All small businesses in the country can benefit from the eight different tax cuts that the president has in the small business assistance bill, as well as giving them credit. And it's clear that if you take as a package the president's plan of extend the middle class tax cuts, pass the business tax incentives he called for, and his small business bill, it's far more pro-business than is passing significant tax cuts for people that make very substantial amounts of money, which all objective analysts have said are the least effective way to get the economy going.
Let's talk about the broader economy here. The 9.6% unemployment rate that we're looking at right now, GDP just 1.6% in the second quarter. When you look at those numbers, where do you say we are right now? And what do you say to people who think we are headed for a double-dip recession?
Well, I don't think we're headed for a double-dip recession. But what I would say to most people, you don't need to be an economic expert to know that we have been in a very tough spot and it will continue to be a difficult road. Now, there are certainly bright spots. We've had eight straight months of private sector job growth. I think we just have to keep working away at it, because when you're that far down, it's going to take time to get out, but we're on the right path, and I think we just got to do everything we can to accelerate the growth rate and accelerate the hiring.
Would a realistic view right now be, look, we're stuck where we are right now for a good stretch of time. We'd better get used to it. Things might get a little bit better, but we're not going to be seeing great growth. We're not going to be seeing a great change in unemployment.
No, but I certainly don't think we should adopt a kind of a fatalist view that, you know, we were down in a deep hole and it's going to take us a while to get out, so we should just give up. I mean, I don't think it makes logical sense, and I don't think it makes practical sense here either. There's no question that as you come out of major financial crises, it's always hard, no matter what country you look at where they've had that, it's always hard to get out. But we're on a path to recover, and we got to keep working down that path, and we got to do everything we can to accelerate the growth. I certainly don't think we should give up. That would be a terrible idea.
We did have $787 billion in stimulus spending. Why do you think it hasn't had more of a stimulative effect in what was supposed to be recovery summer?
Well, I'd say two things about that. Much has been made about the recovery summer, but it is the case that the vice president was talking about recovery summer in reference to the Recovery Act and the projects that would be coming online over this summer. What the Recovery Act did is stop the free fall. The private sector had completely frozen, and the Recovery Act, along with what happened from the Fed, prevented that from turning into a depression. And it did create, according not just to the government, but also according to private sector forecasters and the nonpartisan CBO, it did create millions more jobs than would have existed if it weren't there.
One last question. Austin Goolsbee, given the political climate that we're in right now, would you say that stimulus has become a dirty word verboten in the White House?
Look, I don't know. I'm not an English professor. I'm just an economist, and I tend to think in numbers.
We don't hear that word used very much these days.
A semantic view of it. I know we need to get the growth rate up, and we need to do everything we can to get people back to work. And, you know, whatever you want to call that, that's what everybody's thinking about doing.
Okay. Austin Goolsbee, thanks very much.
Okay. Nice talking to you, Melissa.
Austin Goolsbee is the chairman of the White House Council of Economic Advisors.
One way businesses are coping with hard times is by selling goods out of so-called pop-up stores. That way, they can avoid the cost of long-term leases and long-term obligations to workers. These outlets appear in malls and other locations for only a few months. NPR's Jamie Tarabay visited a pop-up Halloween shop.
In the window of the Halloween Express in the Northern Virginia Mall, a skeleton sits at cards with a mummy. On the table are gold coins and severed fingers. Inside the store, a witch cackles over a crystal ball, and mummies creak as they sit up out of their graves.
We've been here since, I'd say, day before Labor Day.
Eddie Hill has worked at Halloween Express the past 6 years.
During the off-season, you try and struggle to find work, especially in this time of day. But with the economy and all right now, so, yeah. Luckily, this always pops up, and when it does, you know, I'm always invited back.
This pop-up store is filling a space next to the Cheesecake Factory and the Corner Bakery. The previous permanent tenant, a furniture store, filed for national bankruptcy. Hill says it's an arrangement that works for the store's owner and for the mall.
We do very good business for them, and it brings in good revenue for the mall.
The mall's management agrees. Ferris Kaplan is the marketing director for Fair Oaks Mall in Fairfax, Virginia. Filling that empty space brings in rent and customers.
It just helps the traffic in the center. It helps the traffic down those wings of the mall. It just brings more people to the surrounding stores who are there permanently.
The seasonal pop-up store phenomenon is driven by cheap retail space, says Stephen Hoke, marketing professor at the Wharton School in Pennsylvania. Malls offer lower rents to the temporary stores rather than leave storefronts empty.
I think it's a combination of available real estate and the fact that there are just certain products that sell at certain times of year, and people like the convenience and going to one place that specializes in it.
Big-name retailers are trying to capitalize on lower rents to increase their presence and improve store sales by renting pop-up stores. Toys R Us Express stores are opening in 600 locations. Best Buy is operating shop fronts in malls to hawk its mobile phone line, all in time for the holidays. College student Elizabeth Renner is browsing the costumes of the Halloween Express with a friend. She already has ideas about what she might wear more than a month from now.
Thinking about being a lion. This is a really cute lion costume.
Both girls say they prefer to come to an actual store to see the clothes for themselves and try them on, rather than go online. And getting in early, says Renna, is important.
I think it's better to do it now, so before they like sell out and like don't get your size, so.
Throughout the store, pinned above Buzz Lightyear costumes and President Obama masks, are signs stating unequivocally that sales are final, which they have to be. Anyone who tries to return a costume to the shop after Halloween will find a store selling toys for Christmas instead. Jamie Tarabay, NPR News.